goes down there, the evolution of quantum field, particle content, and classicality in the three-stage universe, being the title of the publication on which this talk is based, renamed it at Zip, Zap, and Zoom. That is what I call the three-stage universe-like. So I'll be starting off with the outline of my talk. I'll give you some motivations. What's the point in doing all this, really? And then I'll introduce the arena where all these things will happen, which is the three-stage universe, which has inflation, the first de-Sitter stage, radiation, and then a late-time de-Sitter stage, which is lambda-dominated. And then I'll introduce the fields, which are the players in the arena, and then the show are particle creation and quantum to classical transition. And then finally, I'll summarize and mention some things about future prospects. So here's the motivation. The large scale structures, CMB allostrotropies, and cosmic magnetic fields, they're all believed to be having primordial origin. They're believed to be seeded during inflation through quantum fluctuations. And these fluctuations, they have amplitudes only at the Planck scales. But during inflation, these are stretched out and to galactic scales with nearly unchanged amplitudes. These are what we see as the current day structures everywhere. So this calls for a quantum to classical transition. And there have been mechanisms like decoherence, et cetera, which have been invoked to explain such a thing. But still, till now, we are not very clear about how this happens. And this is, of course, very important to understand, also quite interesting. Of course, there are many other features which I'll talk about later on. So the three-stage universe, first of all. What do we have? We got the inflationary de-Sitter, the radiation, and the late-time accelerated de-Sitter phase. The scale factor of such a universe is given by this, where we have matched the scale factor and its derivative at the transition points, and the transition times are fixed by matching alone. It's useful to use the scale factor itself as a time parameter because it's monotonic. So one can also express the same thing in terms of the co-moving Hubble radius with the in this form. Also, another thing to note that is we have two scales here, the H inflation and H lambda, and these can be related through a parameter epsilon, and epsilon for our real universe is very, very, very small. So when you use the scale factor as a time parameter, the co-moving Hubble radius goes like this. So it's 1 over A for the de-Sitter space, de-Sitter stage, goes like linearly with A in the radiation. Yeah?
So you missed the matter phase. Is that just for simplicity? Because I would think if you miss out matter domination, then you can't have any growth fluctuations.
No.
Because
so
you won't get the right matter power spectrum.
No, the thing is, matter domination only lasted for, say, 4 decades. I mean, it's considerably less than the radiation domination.
Right. So it's just for simplicity?
Yeah, this is just a toy, toy model, which is quite close to the real one, but we're just introducing it to see what the test fields on this particular structure behave like. But of course, matter domination lasts for a very small time. So it's just, radiation domination is for 24 decades and matter is just 4 decades. So
this
is
essential to get.
But it's essential, yeah, of course, yeah. So, so this is the case for the co-moving Hubble radius. Of course, this can be pictorially represented in this way, that we have the, so in a log-log graph, the first de-Sitter space, then the radiation, and finally the lambda-dominated late-time accelerated phase. So this, basically this rich structure gives rise to two length scales in the problem, which are L max, L, and L minimum, such that all the length scales which are greater than L max, once they exit the Hubble radius during the inflationary stage and are always super Hubble. the ones which are inside this band, they exit the Hubble during the first inflationary stage, and then they re-enter the Hubble in the radiation, and they exit again during the third stage. While any length scale or modes which are below L minimum, they always stay sub-Hubble until, of course, sometime in the late time phase where they exit again. So this band provides a rich terrain which actually gives rise to non-trivial effects on quantum fields, as we'll see. So quantum fields are basically, the main thing is that what happens to quantum fields is that under strong external fields, the vacuums behave like a medium, and the vacuum shows dispersive effects, which are termed as vacuum polarization. And the second effect is of particle creation, which is also called the absorptive effect. The flat spacetime examples of this particular case are the Schwinger effect, where you have particle production due to strong electric fields, and the Casimir effect, where there are non-trivial effects due to boundaries. Now, you put these quantum fields on curved spacetime, and gravity plays essentially the same role as of an external field. But there's some differences here and there. For example, in stationary situations, we have the existence of time-like Killing vectors, and there we can define what are called the in and out states, and we can relate these in and out states to get particle creation and things like that. For example, in the case of Hawking effect. However, in the expanding case, expanding universe, the differences there are differences. There are no time-like killing vectors, so there is no unique definition of a vacuum state. And second thing being, you cannot switch off the background. So you do not have any free fields except in the past. So the notion of particles, etc., is a bit ambiguous in expanding universe, in cosmological phase. So at best, we can construct different quantities and try to interpret them, what they mean like. So we have two pictures to study quantum fields. One is the Heisenberg picture, and the second one is the Schrodinger picture. And it turns out that in the case which we are interested in, that is the time-dependent particle creation and the evolution of classicality, the degree of classicality as time progresses, the Schrodinger picture is much more suitable. So I'll just introduce the Schrodinger framework to work with quantum fields, first of all, and then we'll talk about what happens when you introduce the cosmological structure of three-stage universe. So the essence of this thing is that quantum fields are essentially harmonic oscillators, and their vacuum states are given by a Gaussian wave function. And in the presence of expanding background, the frequency and mass of the oscillators, it becomes time dependent. This can be easily seen by looking at massless minimally coupled scalar field and Fourier decomposing it because of translation symmetry. And so that we have, in terms of the real phi k variables, Fourier components, the action is just of a harmonic oscillator with time-dependent mass and time-dependent frequency. So you can immediately write then the Schrodinger equation for the wave functional of the field. And this looks like this. And this Schrodinger equation, it admits form-invariant Gaussian states with vanishing mean. This is also called squeeze states, which are of this form, so that when you substitute this particular ansatz into this equation, you immediately get equation for alpha and n. And for alpha, you get this particular equation. N basically depends on alpha and alpha star, so it's not independent of it. Also, you can equivalently put it in this particular form, which actually measures the deviation from adiabaticity. If the modes are adiabatic, they will just So how does the wave function of a harmonic oscillator look like? For a vacuum wave function, the vacuum state is Gaussian, and the parameters here are m omega by 2 times e. So the m omega come here basically as a square and k, which are time dependent, and anything which is away from the adiabatic evolution is characterized by this parameter z, which we call the excitation parameter. It should be clear in a short while why this is the excitation parameter. So you have two equations, I mean, either for alpha or for z. And with these equations are second order, first order nonlinear equations, but they can be converted to second order linear equations because they're of Riccati type equations. So with this particular substitution, you can convert them into second order linear equation. Though the surprising point is for this variable mu, this equation exactly resembles the field equation for phi k. If you would have extremized that action for phi k, you would have got this field equation. So exactly the same thing. And zk is related to mu through this particular expression. Being second order differential equation, it admits two solutions. And we need to specify the boundary conditions in order to get what mu k is. And given, but to note that z, the physical variable z or alpha, they just depend on the ratio of m, k dot by mk. So it's only, we only need to fix this particular ratio b by a. And once we have fixed this, we would have solved the whole problem. So we can set the initial conditions by demanding that in the asymptotic past, the initial state is of zero particle content. So at any time, say eta equal to eta I, or when a is ai, the initial condition of the wave function being a ground state just requires this particular thing, or in terms of mu, this condition to be satisfied. So for any time greater than a, ai, after we have set the initial state, what does the state look like? The state is not no longer, I mean, it's different from ground state. It is no longer a zero particle state. So one would like to know what is the instantaneous particle content of that particular state. And it's reasonable to compare it with instantaneous eigenstates of the harmonic oscillator, which are obtained by adiabatically evolving the initial ground state at that time. So these are the instantaneous eigenstates, and when you compare them, compare the evolved state with this particular instantaneous eigenstate, you can get the probability for transitions to have occurred. And the vacuum persistent probability gives you the instantaneous particle content. So you can find the instantaneous particle content, and in terms of Z, this is the kind of form which it has. So note that this average particle number is not monotonic in general, and this can go up and down. It can have fluctuations on top of it. So merely thinking it as a classical particle is not really advised. So it has some fluctuations on top. That is the main thing. So we need to understand how much classical such a state is. That brings us to quantifying the degree of classicality. Yeah?
Is your initial state there the same as the bunch state?
Sorry?
Your initial condition was the same as particle state. Is that the same as the bunch vacuum?
Yeah, that's vacuum state. Yeah. So that depends on where you set the initial condition. So I set it at some general eta equal to eta I. If you set it at very fast, which I will be, that corresponds to the usual bunch Davies vacuum. So classicality is usually quantified by the use of Wigner functions and the correlation between the momenta and the position. So the state is said to be classical if the Wigner function peaks on the classical trajectory. That is, the momenta is some function of q. However, naively depending upon the Wigner function, can lead to ambiguities. So we propose a classicality parameter, which is given by this. Essentially, it's the correlation between the momenta and the position variable. And for a field system for which we are using with Gaussian states, the Wigner function looks like this, and the classicality parameter is this particular form. So you see, if the state is quantum mechanical, entirely purely quantum, there is no correlation between phi and pi. So this scry k is zero, and hence the classicality parameter is zero. Otherwise, this, when there is a large correlation, it is bounded between the interval minus 1 and 1. So departure from 0 tells you departure from the quantum nature. So now we have all the things. We have the three stages. We have the equations for mu, the field system. We have the particle instantaneous particle content, and also the classicality parameter. You can just go and straight off solve these things. So that is what we do. We solve for mu in the various stages and use the boundary conditions such that the field evolves from bunch Davis vacuum state.
I
yeah.
Just have a question about
no, sorry.
So usually this is the squeezing parameter, right?
Yeah.
So can you say why? So in a coherent state, this would be zero, and if it's not zero, usually you interpret the state as being squeezed. So why do you relate that to classicality?
Oh, see, the.
So you're saying if it's not zero.
Yeah, it's not zero. It's not zero. Yeah.
No, but so why do you call it classical?
It would not be zero in a coherent state.
Not equal to zero is not classical.
No, in a coherent state, by definition, you demand the squeezing p q.
Yeah, that would be. No, no. See, when you take a squeeze state, for instance, okay, the squeeze state. May or may not be classical. It again, that's what I'm saying. It depends on the Wigner function where it peaks. Okay, and much more robust definition of classicality would be in the form of exact correlation between p and q. That is what we use.
Q equal 1 would be the.
Yeah, that would be classical. Yeah, that's the maximum value. C equal to 1 is classical. That is the thing. So it's entirely bounded between minus 1 and 1. And 0 will be quantum mechanical, 1 will be classical.
So first, I think it would be helpful if you showed us the definition of C again. Can you show us again the definition of C?
What? So you have PQ. So this is just the correlation between momenta and of course, to know whether this thing works is only can be, I mean, it can be judged by using various examples. And
I'm not sure what you call that classical parameter, I guess, with the question. I mean, suppose I take a Bartman coherent state. In that case, this guy would be C, even if the state is very fixed around the classical trajectory. So this mixing between P and Q has some meaning, but I'm not sure why you call it the classical.
I think, I mean, the point is that if P and Q are just one number, then but average of P times Q is average of P times average of Q, and average of P squared is just average of P squared. So I mean, they all cancel, but there is no averaging that becomes one. But then if it's a large distribution, then.
If.
Because you don't subtract the.
No. So, and. So other thing which I was saying was referring to was that the only way this can be found to be, I mean, a valid thing would be to use it in various things, various examples. And one of the examples where this can be used is in the case of Schwinger effect. So you just have plane homogeneous electric field creating pairs out of the vacuum. So again, you have the vacuum persistent probability and the particle content. And it turns out that this parameter indeed gives you the classical description for how things, go from, you have earlier ground state which are quantum mechanical, how you get particles from it, and the classical description of those particles. Because those particles are the one which back react on the plates. And so there it is found that it indeed works. So that is why here also, actually we'll find out that it indeed gives you the notion of classicality. So the boundary condition, as I was stressing, that it's chosen that the field system evolves from a Bunch Davis vacuum state, and which is defined in the asymptotic past, and all these constants C, D, E, F, they are fixed by matching at the transition points. Once you have done that, you can look at what the particle content N and Z and C look like. And first of all, I'll just give you the numerical plots, then I'll go and look at the analytical expressions for the same. So we choose H equal to 1 and epsilon as 0.01 and two cases for the epsilon. Of course, for the realistic value of epsilon, these things do not work. You have to look at analytics. So some very interesting features emerge out of the analysis, which are these. That is, if you look at Z, for instance, Z is in general a complex quantity, and in the first De-Sitter space phase, it evolves away from Z equal to zero, and then when it enters the radiation phase, it starts to move around, circle around, and then even when the universe has exited the radiation phase, in the third stage, also it is moving around, and then it goes back to unity after some time. So, and similarly is the particle content, and this is for the case of 0.0001, so 10⁻⁴. This should be compared with this particular graph which we had. So. Yeah, this is the Z.
Yeah, but this one.
Yeah, this one is the particle number. That's all I'm just coming to it.
Okay. Yeah.
So you compare it with the graph we had earlier. We have two length scales, L max and N minimum. Similarly, for NK, we look at what is the average particle number, time dependent particle number, for various scales corresponding to k minimum, which corresponds to L max, scale corresponding which is k max corresponds to L minimum, and we have a band in between. So essentially, everything up there is super Hubble, and everything down below is sub Hubble, and anything in between is the intermediate stage where a mode exits, re-enters, and again exits. So what? K actually,
grows.
I mean, these are plotted for different k's.
K is a constant. Yeah, so where is the vk in the small k?
Where's what?
Vk in small k.
See.
On your drawing, too. So where is it? Small k is on the top.
L max is k mean?
No, see, 1 over k is L max.
Okay. And where is L max in your
See, you have L max here.
Yeah.
This particular state.
This
K minimum is what corresponds to L max. Yeah. I mean, K is 2 pi by L. So
what is epsilon?
Epsilon is the ratio of H inflation to H now, or H lambda. Okay, so it just enters as a parameter in it. It just changes the way this looks like. This just changes the scale. No, no, what? Epsilon? Yeah, so. In reality, epsilon is 10 power minus 54, right? So, but if you want to draw the numerics for that, would not be.
Yeah, that's my guess. You would not see that
calculation. Yeah. But there are analytical expressions for that, which will tell you what will happen for in that case. Essentially, what will happen is this will be stretched. I mean, for very small epsilon, this keeps on stretching, because these transition points, they depend on epsilon, so it stretches.
Sorry, and the overall scale, so the number of particles will grow.
Yeah.
What is the constant?
It's okay. It in a log plot, it's linearly increasing.
What is the scale of epsilon?
No, no. So, see. Epsilon is here.
So n dot is a constant. What is this
constant? See, epsilon is actually here. When you are providing the transition times, what are the transition times? They depend on h inflation and h lambda. So this is fixed. This is epsilon times this. So hence. This would be stretched in A. That is the only place where epsilon comes in, nowhere else.
So in your diagram, you also have that n dot, the number of particles per unit time.
Per unit time?
Is constant, independent of k. So it looks like that. In your diagram.
I think it's a log log diagram.
So yeah, that's what I'm asking. What is the law for log of n dot?
Log.
It looks like it's a constant.
Yeah.
What is it? You're saying the particle, you know, seems to grow. So here, log of, so you have a constant rate of growth.
Yeah.
N. So what is this rate? Like this slope you have.
No, I didn't understand. Tell me again.
You know, what is expression for n dot?
Yeah. You see, log of n dot looks like a constant.
Yeah.
So what is this constant?
No, wait. N goes like A. Okay. Here, A square actually. So in
N always grow like A square.
For the super Hubble. This straight line which we see here. Here N is going like A square. Okay, and for the scales, for the modes which are.
So you're saying the particle density goes down?
Yeah.
The number of particles, yeah.
This is hard, you shouldn't really interpret it as the number of particles it's because they are super Hubble modes.
This is N, yeah, that is what I'm saying. Yeah. This N has K with it. So this is the average number of particles of the mode K.
Well,
the definition of the number of particles, is it in co-moving frame?
Co-moving.
And then you're saying basically like something like because when we do Minkowski number of particles, because it's not cosmological, in fact, then you have to compare it with one state in radiation, for example, what is the definition?
See, initially, you had a bunch Davis state, okay? You have no particles, everything is zero. And then, when you have evolved it, you have the wave functional, which is not the same as the ground state. What you're doing is, you are comparing it with the instantaneous eigenstates at that particular instant later on. And what I'm looking at is the transitions which have taken in the particular K mode.
So I like ambiguity in Minkowski,
You can, yeah.
Yeah, what you interpret as number of particles is not that.
So that it's yeah, instantaneous. And also another thing, if you calculate the Hamiltonian, for example, in this particular case, it turns out to be this nk plus half h cross omega. So that is why you would interpret it as particles. But then that is what I'm stressing at, is that when this nk fluctuates, for example, for the sub-Hubble modes or the modes which are inside, then you can no longer really think of it as particles. It's ambiguous to think of them as particles because the numbers are all fluctuating. There's quantum fluctuation on top of them. So I would not actually think about them as particles in this particular case, only when the fluctuations are small. Or other thing which you can do is you can always time average it. So you can take a time averaging of it, then in an integrated manner, that will give you the number of particles. And the complete number of particles is, of course, integral over dk, integral dk nk. So you can integrate it over this particular band, for example, from k max to k minimum, and find what is the energy contained in this band, or what is the even the number of particles in this band. I mean, k dk times nk will give you the energy, basically.
Time you put all the nk equal to zero, so your diagrams, they look like they are parallel here, but
that actually goes to asymptote. Yeah, then a log plot, it doesn't cannot show it a equal to zero.
Nk is really the number of particles, is the number of it's the density.
Density.
So it's an occupation number. It's a number of particles per mode.
Per mode.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So okay. So if I want to get the density, I divide by aq. And this one is decaying.
So these are the density, actually, yeah. So
these are the density.
Yeah.
The density is growing.
Number density, yeah.
The number density, okay.
Yeah.
So the number density is growing.
Yeah.
Okay.
So what we have here is one thing that the non-zero values of zk, so they basically imply departure from adiabatic regime. That is, after you have set in, the evolution is no longer adiabatic because it's all going around in a complex plane. And second, there's a surprising memory effect. That is, ZK in the stage 3, it continues to circle a bit. So there's a memory effect. Even when the universe has made a transition, the field does not know about the transition. And stays in its own phase. And NK we see follows a power law in inflationary D-sitter. Is this actually goes like A square. And subsequent behavior in the radiation phase, it depends on what is the scale of the mode, so where it lies. So for example, the modes which are super Hubble, which have exited the inflationary stage at the time of inflationary stage, they always go like a power law, whereas the modes which re-enter the Hubble radius and in the radiation phase, they begin to oscillate. And if we will not have any third stage, this NK in the radiation stage, it saturates independent of the value of epsilon. This would be saturating, and there is a particular expression for that. And there is, of course, a residual memory effect. That is, even when the universe has made a transition, there's a memory which holds on. And it also in the third stage, for example, there's a memory effect which carries on. So what happens for the classicality parameter, which tells you what is happening in the case of n. If you look at the classicality parameter for three different scales, this is the one which always remain sub-horizon, sub-Hubble. This is the intermediate one, and this is the one which exits the Hubble in the first stage and is always super-Hubble. So you see that the one which has exited the horizon in the inflationary de-sitter, the classicality parameter, which starts from 0, drops to 1, 1 or minus 1. So it, the magnitude of it is 1 unity. So what is what?
We cannot see. Where is 0 and where is 1?
This is 0 here. And this is 0.5, minus 0.5, this is minus 1. So it starts from a quantum.
Where is classical?
Here's classical. This is quantum mechanical. 0 is quantum mechanical,
either
pure quantum.
Is there 1 or minus
1? Yeah, 1 or minus 1 is class. So modulus of C is to be basically.
So this one is modulus.
This is 1. I mean, the transition is very fast for this. So it becomes classical. So, I mean, here we see what I was telling you about, the exact quantify, I mean, how to quantify the classicality in relation to Hubble exit. When the mode exits the Hubble stage, it becomes classical. So for example, if you see the intermediate stage, the mode comes in here, and it has exited the Hubble in this case at this point. So this can actually be seen here. So these are the exit for this particular mode. Here is where it exits the Hubble scale. Here it re-enters the Hubble scale. And here it exits again. So if you see it here, it's again the same thing. When it exits the Hubble scale, it comes to minus 1. It's classical. But it has entered the Hubble scale again. So it starts oscillating in the radiation phase. That is why we see fluctuations in NK. That is, the state is no longer classical once it has re-entered the Hubble. There are fluctuations. And once it exits again in the late time, it becomes classical. So we have quantum fluctuations on top of it. This is one of the cases which I'll come to in a while, why this is important to see. So one thing to take from here is that the classicality parameter, it tracks down the behavior of average particle number, why it is oscillating and all that. And second thing, it relates to why the modes become classical on Hubble exit. So for the cosmological case, the winding number is very high. So we cannot really do the numerics here, but we can look at the analytical results. For the inflationary de-sitter, we have these other results. That is, nk goes like a square. So it's a power in log log. It's just linear in a. And the classicality parameter is given by this. So immediately here we see for super Hubble, this is unity. For the radiation phase, the expressions look like this. One thing to note here is the one which I was telling you about. If you look at the asymptotic asymptotic limit in the radiation phase, NK saturates to this particular value, which is independent of epsilon. But for the third stage, things go quite out of hand because the analytical expressions are very cumbersome and complicated. So I will not show them here. How cumbersome they are, well, you can judge them from this very fact. They don't fit the slide. So essentially, what we can do is we can approximate under suitable approximation, suitable assumption, that our epsilon is less than 1. And then we find that NK goes like this particular, the NK has this expression, which for super Hubble reduces to the same power law expansion, power law behavior as a square. And for the intermediate stage, it actually fits well with the oscillations and then, how it behaves after the Hubble exit. So this can be seen through this, that these are the oscillations which we had, and this expression tells you exactly where at the Hubble exit the power law behavior starts again in the third stage. What? Red is this.
N is E square H4.
This is in the third stage. Particle.
Yeah, no. What is E?
What is what?
E. You have a letter E. What does it represent?
Oh, E. Epsilon.
Epsilon or?
No, no. E is exponential. The exponent. Yeah. Nothing unusual. So what are the implications for cosmology? The assumptions which are normally made in the inflationary paradigm are the following: that the quantum fluctuations behave classical on Hubble exit, and second thing is once they are classical, they always remain classical. So what is the notion of this classicality? We use the classicality parameter to define what the classicality is. Then we see that A is found to be true, that the modes do become classical on Hubble exit, but B is not, that they do not remain classical once they have turned classical. So when they re-enter the Hubble, they oscillate again. So sub-Hubble modes therefore have oscillations on them. Possibly it's important that to see whether we can have any imprints of these on on the observations and things like that. So we need a mechanism or methodology which takes into account both the aspects, the classical aspect as well as the quantum mechanical aspect, the fluctuations on the field. So the points are the following: that we have a methodology to treat the evolution of quantum field in a realistic universe. We took three stages here as a toy model with inflationary distributor, radiation, and late time accelerated phase. I looked at the time dependent particle, average particle content of the field and the degree of classicality in an integrated manner through the whole history of the universe. And there are some non-trivial features which emerge out of this particular game. Essentially, the particle number and degree of classicality depend on the scale of the mode. And the particle number we see is it grows linearly in the log-log plot for D-sitter and super Hubble modes, but it oscillates for those which enter the radiation phase, and it saturates asymptotically in independent of epsilon were the third stage not be there. But if there is a third stage, then we again see the D-sitter-like behavior. There is a residual memory effect even after the transitions. The classicality parameter, it tracks the whole behavior nicely. It specifies clearly how the classicality emerges out on horizon exit. And this has some implications which would leave, I mean, there would be some effect of these oscillations possibly on the large-scale structures or things like, I mean, or even anisotropies in CMB, but which needs to be seen because this scheme was applied to a test scalar field on this particular background. One needs to see what happens really for the case of cosmological perturbations. Those, the scalar modes as well as the tensor modes of perturbations, how they behave. Because there you need to incorporate even the back reaction on the geometry. So the future prospects are these. As I've already mentioned, what happens for the case of cosmological perturbations? And then there's a question, what would be the case if you would start with a non-Bunch Davis vacuum kind of state in the past? And then there's a second effect. I mean, this work focused on particle creation, but there was a second effect also of quantum fields, which is called the vacuum polarization. And it turns out that it opens another area in the sense that photons or electromagnetic fields, they can acquire mass, a non-zero mass during inflation. And this can have possible implications on the generation of cosmic magnetic fields. It would be actually interesting to see in the evolution of three stages how this mass evolves. I mean, if there is a non-zero mass in the beginning, how it evolves so that it should almost vanish in the late stage, because currently we do not see any mass of the photon. This can be used in various cases. And another case is to look for similar effects in the case of a Coleman-Deluchere transition. There it would be something related to the wave function of the universe transiting from the false vacuum to the true vacuum. And then, of course, there's something to think about what would happen if you have a minimum length scale in space-time. Would there be any trans-Planckian effects that would get amplified in this particular picture, and would they give rise to some observational effects? And there are many other things. So that would be all. One thing which I can mention here is that you can also talk to me about black holes and de-Sitter spacetimes. These are some of my other works which I've been doing. Thank you. I didn't get you. What did you say?
Is your state a squeeze state or a coherent state?
Squeeze state.
It's a squeeze state. Okay, so that's weird because normally when we think about what are the most classical quantum states, we usually think of a coherent state which has a large mean but small quantum population. But now you have a squeeze state. It's not squeezed along.
An important point here is that although these are squeezed, there is a departure from the adiabaticity. This is not the adiabatically evolved states, version states.
Yeah, but it's still at zero mean. But why do you then?
As long as you're doing linear physics, you always get zero mean. The mean doesn't tend to be linear.
Yeah, but then.
That's as classical as it gets using linear physics.
I guess your question is that you talked only about one parameter, which is so I guess what you're asking is are these states coherent in the sense that they minimize the uncertainty relation?
The Wigner function.
They minimize what?
The uncertainty relation.
What
about the evolution? That's the first question.
I'm not sure about that. But I guess they would because
I guess there are, but that's somehow, that's the first question. And then the second question is, assuming that they are, if they are, really coherent in the sense they minimize the configuration that's preserved by the evolution, not only you need to look at this PQ correlation, but also you need to know what is the coherent length.
Ah, yes.
Right? So I'm sure you have it in your calculation. How these coherent lengths evolve this time? And how is it affected? Because classicality is also about that. It's also about, what is the range of fluctuation in spatial distance.
I see. Yeah.
So you want an object to, a classical object would be something that doesn't mix P and Q, but also something that somehow has a fluctuation length which is comparable to.
Yeah, normally you would really associate when the Wigner function becomes correlated so that. It peaks on the classical trajectory. P is a function of Q, which is the classical trajectory.
Yeah, but in your state, there's going to be a coherent energy in the coherent length, something that controls the fluctuation of P and the fluctuation of Q.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And you want to know, assuming they are coherent, they are inverse to each other.
Yeah.
Right? But then you want to know how they evolve.
Let's
say, a state will not be coherent, will not be very classical if the coherent length starts to really be very big.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know how much.
I don't know.
You mentioned there could be observational consequences of this. And I was just thinking about that. So the fluctuations you can use are the fluctuations that are field that is present during inflation. or they become classical when they enter the horizon, then when they re-enter the horizon, they have this quantum oscillation. For that to be something that's observable, that field would have to survive into the current epoch. I mean, I would think for something like the radiation fluctuations, the adiabatic CMB fluctuation, this is the inflaton seeding those, but it's going to decay during reheating to actually generate the radiation. So that the reheating phase, I would think, would just scramble everything. So that the photon perturbations, they become, so the inflaton becomes classical, exits the horizon, decays, creates photons, which are super horizon modes. And I don't think anything could make them become quantum mechanical again, because there's not much coherence. So I would think for the adiabatic modes, I don't know if this would be relevant. Something where it might be relevant would be fields that are around during inflation and are still around today. So it'd be something like isokurvature modes.
Like,
so
for example,
like an axion isokurvature mode, to field that's around, it would totally do this and it survives until today. But for anything that's seeded by adiabatic inflation perturbations, my intuition would just be that reheating scrambles everything.
Oh.
So I would think this is only relevant for isokurvature.
But what about tensor perturbations? Or that,
the tensor perturbations,
yeah, that
matter.
Actually behave like box phi equal to zero.
Yeah, no, you're right. Yeah, tensors
yeah.
would also work.
Yeah, so tensor perturbations would be more like these.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But
tensors and isokurvature are things that don't have to be from decay. But in the adiabatic mode, I would just think that we
Any other questions?